Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine, Eddie Alterman. Eddie, good afternoon.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for being on the show. I'm very excited about this. I've been reading Car and Driver forever. It's a fantastic magazine, and I want to hear the story about how you got to be editor-in-chief. And then later, we'll talk about cars and autonomous cars and geek out. How's that sound?
Great. And both are long and sordid tales.
Well, let's get into it because, I write for a living too, and it's always an interesting story to hear about other people's inspirations, ambitions. But let's start at the beginning. So tell me about growing up. It's easy for young men to fall in love with cars, but how did it happen for you?
I had a bit of a head start because my father was a total car nut. He used to sell used cars on Livernois Avenue when he was a teenager in Detroit. So I grew up in Detroit and, right off of Woodward Avenue, M1, the first paved road in America, and you'd see development mules all over town. And if you weren't excited about it, you just weren't paying attention. And this was in the 70s when cars really were awful in Detroit. And it's what we call the malaise era now. But even then, it was very, very exciting for me. And my dad, I think, stoked the flame. Certainly, he did with issues of Car and Driver. He would leave, the magazine open for me on the dining room table after he left for work and before I went to school.
When did Car and Driver start publishing?
We started as Sports Cars Illustrated in Washington, D.C. in 1955. But my dad, I guess, started reading it shortly thereafter. He was a big David E. Davis fan. Oh. And after Davis moved from Car and Driver to Automobile, when he started Automobile in 1986, my dad migrated with him and took me along with him. But I always read these magazines and thought that the guys in them were just living the best possible life. They got to drive all the new stuff. They got to go to, they got to go to all these cool places and talk to interesting people when they got there. And I kind of designed my whole life around wanting to do this. And now I look back on it, it's kind of a monastic, singular kind of pursuit. But it was great. I went to the University of Michigan precisely because there were two car magazines there. And I kept knocking on the door.
You mean published at the university?
Well, no. Both Car and Driver and Automobile were headquartered. Their editorial
office in Ann Arbor.
Headquartered in Ann Arbor, right? So I just kept knocking on their doors until one of them let me in. And it turned out that turned out to be Automobile, where I got to meet David E. Davis finally. One of the great kind of joys of my professional life was that I got to introduce my dad to his kind of literary hero, Davis, and they became buddies. So that was fun. And that certainly didn't hurt my career at that place. So that was really good.
Being in the right place at the right time and being connected. Did you major in journalism proper?
I did not. I majored in English just because, as fascinated as I was in cars, I was equally fascinated by words and by the media business too, which I thought was just a really exciting place to be. And, the car sits at this intersection of all of these different disciplines and pursuits, from design, manufacturing, issues of personal freedom, oil and gas, all this stuff is kind of wrapped up in the car. I feel media is kind of the same way, hugely dynamic. It's responding kind of in real time to people's desires and wants. And it's kind of a fascinating intersection between the car and all that it has and journalism. I'm sure you feel sort of the same way, John.
I do. So I started falling in love with Apple when I bought an Apple II and started writing a space shuttle landing simulator and then moved on to the Mac. And it was always on the periphery throughout my career, using Macintoshes in work and writing and doing research papers and so on. And then I finally got a dream come true. I got to work for Apple about 15 years ago. And retired from, didn't retire, but I left my good job at Lockheed Martin to go to work for Apple. And then when I left Apple, then that was natural for me to come to work for the Mac Observer and play and have fun and enjoy what I'm doing and, you know, get up every morning and just enjoy the Apple world and Macintoshes and iPhones and Apple TV and all the jazz. And so I'm kind of like you, just totally immersed in it. Although I don't get to drive a Lamborghini.
But what about SR-71? Do you ever get behind the yoke of that? That's a Lockheed Martin Skunk Works project, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I worked for Lockheed Martin Astronautics, so I was on the space and satellite side of it here in Denver. Yeah, so I can't really get into what I was doing, but had a lot of fun. So speaking of computers, did you kind of feel like you were dragged into computers and somebody came in one day and put a terminal in front of you and said, "Hey, Eddie, you're going to write on this?" or were you into computers as well?
Well, to me, I was a little bit more device agnostic. We started writing at Automobile on these ATEX machines. Do you remember those?
No, I don't. Tell me about that.
They were kind of like a very primitive desktop publishing platform where the hardware and the software were kind of fused. You know, this huge machine only did one thing. And it was an ATEX machine that did ATEX. And you would type on this, I think it was an LCD screen.
I bet it was a CRT.
CRT. And it was just green type on a black background. Mm-hmm. And so when we started getting Macs, because Macs are the preferred hardware for and software for our operating system
for publishing,
it was a joy because everything was so clearly laid out, and you know, it was just so intuitive and so great, and you could see Steve Jobs' love for the human brain in his products. You could see that he respected how people thought and worked and made connections between their hands and their brains. And
does that continue to today? Are you guys, all the editors of Car and Driver, using Macintoshes by chance?
Absolutely.
That's great.
The testers use PCs because that's what the test equipment marries with. Mm-hmm. We do use Parallels to get from the PCs to the Macs.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. This is better than I expected. This is very cool.
Just got a new machine. So I'm a Apple guy for sure.
Excellent. So tell me how you progressed through the career. You started writing an Automobile magazine. Did you write continuously or finally arriving at Car and Driver, or were there some fits and starts? How did that go?
A lot of fits and starts. And, you know, back in those days, you couldn't just start writing. It wasn't like we had this kind of blog economy where if you wanted to learn how to write about cars or you wanted to write about cars, you just started to do it.
You had to have a respectable job. You had to send in a resume, right?
Exactly. They were gatekeepers. So it was a little bit like the music business, you know. In order to get published, you had to pass certain tests. So when I started at Automobile under Davis, I was what was known as a motor gopher. And this was college. And my job was to wash gas and deliver the cars. And I can't believe they put me behind the wheel of some of these things. But, you know, when you're 19 years old and you're driving around in a Porsche 911, what's better than that? I was hooked. It was the greatest thing ever. But what it taught me was how a magazine like Car and Driver or Automobile really deals with its raw materials, how the cars are completely essential to everything we do here, and to have respect for that. And that was a great learning opportunity. So I did that when I was in college, and then Davis hired me out of college. And I sort of bounced around within Automobile. I was on the production side. I learned how to copy edit. Then I was on the editorial side. And I really learned how a magazine came together from the raw materials through the word production to photography, and it was an amazing education.
Did you get a chance to hang around with the testers, and ride with them and see the testing equipment that they use and sort of the technology of how they evaluate cars?
Absolutely. And, you know, Automobile was set up to be more of a lifestyle automotive magazine, so they didn't generate their own numbers. And Davis came out of Car and Driver, which was a very tech-oriented environment, lots of engineers on staff. And I think he wanted to pivot away from that and just talk about the joy of the car. So when I came to Car and Driver all those years later, I had a vague inkling of what all the engineers on staff did, but I didn't have the appreciation that I do now. But so I was at Automobile for about 13 years. I left to start my own magazine, drawing on the skills that they had given me. And that lasted all about 18 months. But after that, I became a freelancer and was writing for the New York Times and writing for Men's Journal and GQ, and had a ton of fun doing that. But when my predecessor in this job at Car and Driver, Chevachetta, decided that he wanted to retire, I threw my hat in the ring and they said, yeah, you're cheap enough. And
I remember that when Chubba left, it was a big deal. It was kind of a major loss. Didn't he come back as a part-time writer with you guys?
Oh yeah. He's still writing stuff for the magazine all the time. I didn't want to lose that continuity and his great institutional knowledge. And he had a lot to teach me, quite frankly. So it was great. I mean, now 9 years later, the band is still together. Chubba still writes for us. You know, there's a lot of joy here.
Was there keen competition for that job, or was somebody have you sort of earmarked?
Well, we got to remember, this was back in 2009 when everybody said print was dead and the economy was melting down. We didn't know if the car companies were going to wind up bankrupt. At least two of the three American car companies wind up bankrupt. It was a time of tremendous uncertainty, and I think a lot of people looked at it and said, do I want to be the guy to step into this, you know, bog and try to sort this out? And I was kind of dumb enough and young enough to do it.
Well, that's a very interesting tension that you just mentioned, because we're sort of at a critical point as well now, too, because car technology has gotten really cool. And there's some really fantastic cars and technologies, and Tesla's coming on strong. And yet, seemingly looming on the horizon is this specter of autonomous cars that will sort of take away the joy of the road. And I want to talk to you about that in the second half of the show. So that's kind of interesting to me, too. We'll get into that in a minute.
Yeah, but I think you're right. I've been lucky to preside over this transition here, where we've gone from hardware being the most important thing and people buying cars based on 0 to 60 times and what it had under the hood, to and the joy of that moving toward a kind of software-based convenience type of model, where people are buying cars based on how many USB ports they have in them, and right, and how good the infotainment system is, and are there enough sensors? What is the suite of semi-autonomous functions look like? So it's been a fascinating transition, and Car and Driver has grown, I think, because of that. It's been really well positioned to comment on it, because we have not only car guys here, but also tech guys and gals.
So what is your day like? Do you get to go out and get your hands dirty and drive cars? Or you sit in the office and edit other people's stuff?
I'm chained to my desk. Right. That's not exactly true, but I mean, we've got, you know, 60 people here, and it's a lot of managing, and you know, a lot of great creative types who you know, need to be managed.
Yeah, but if there's a Lamborghini Huracan in the parking lot, and you can probably ask the guy who's testing it, you say, can I go for a ride for lunch?
Exactly. And I generally don't ask, just to but we try to respect the hierarchy here. I'm not the guy who signs out in the coolest cars every night. We have a system that's, you know, as equitable as we could make it, and as egalitarian as we could make it,
good,
I should say.
Good, good. So one last question in this segment. what have been the big changes in Car and Driver since you arrived? What have you been your goals? Has it been sort of maintaining the tradition, or have you put your own stamp on the magazine in special ways? How do you feel about that?
Well, we've seen this proliferation of platforms rise up in the 9 years that I've been here. And at first, it was just sort of print and desktop digital. In those intervening years, we've seen the rise of Facebook, Instagram, and the iPad, and a mix of formats and hardware and platforms. And I think the staff did something really smart altogether when I started. And we did, you know, some real heavy thinking about what the magazine meant and how it could survive. Because its survival is not assured at that point. And we thought about what made the magazine great. We thought about what its first principles were, what its values were, and why people responded to it in an emotional way. And we came up with three things, basically. The magazine was brutally honest. It was fun to read. And it was useful to people. And so those first principles, I think we've been successful in translating those to all the different platforms and all the different, technologies that have cropped up from mobile to podcasts to Facebook. We always think about that. I mean, are we putting out content that is useful, honest, and fun? But that's not to say that we take a magazine story and just shovel it over to the website or onto we turn it into a podcast. We really feel that and I think this is another element of the success of the magazine, is that we really feel like each platform, each medium deserves its own sort of tailored content. And if we're doing it right, we should have really no overlap between what's going on in the magazine and what's happening on the website or what's happening on the mobile site.
Interesting. I think you're doing a very good job at that. I like the way you guys have approached it, and I've seen some great stuff in print and on the web too. So keep up the good work.
Yeah, and you know, the web wants its own stuff. The web affords shoppers a tremendous amount of time compression. You know, as you know, John, when you were reading the magazine pre-internet, it functioned as sort of a crude shopping tool where you would hear about a car or see a spy shot.
There were a few years there where I would only buy a car that was on your top 10 list, period, right. End of discussion.
That's great. So you probably bought a lot of Honda Accords.
Yeah, I did.
And then it's an incredible car.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, these car magazines sort of function like bridal magazines for in-market shoppers, and they would come to them whenever they were, looking for a car, and they, you know, leaf through it for 9 or 10 months, however long it took them to complete their shopping process. But that doesn't happen anymore. The magazine is freed, in a sense, to be more about the love and the passion, the enthusiasm of the machine itself, whereas the digital expression allows people to research and shop and get connected to dealers in a way that was never possible when it was just print. And you've seen usage patterns of shoppers really change based on the technology they're using and the technology available to them.
You said a couple of keywords there, love and passion. I want to talk to you about in the second segment, but right now we're going to have to take a break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. We'll finish up some really geeky stuff with Eddie Alterman, editor-in-chief of Car and Driver, and we'll talk about autonomous cars and the passion of cars. So stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. We're back. I'm chatting with Eddie Alterman. So a few years ago, we heard some tantalizing rumors. I think it was about 2014. About Apple's plans to build an autonomous car. It just grew and grew and grew, and rumors got out of hand, and people started publishing artist concepts of what an Apple car might be like. I remember seeing a boxy version in Car and Driver that I think they even used in an article. It was under the San Francisco Bay Bridge or something like that. What was your reaction at the time when you first heard these rumors?
Well, I knew, one, that Steve and Johnny were both hardcore car guys. So it didn't surprise me. But what did surprise me was how sort of naive it was for those guys to want to dip their toe into it. And I say that with all due respect. Naive because the car business is so regulated and the profit margins are so slim that building the hardware is not where you want to be. And even Elon Musk, you know, he has an end game, I believe, beyond the hardware, which is to really turn himself into a utility provider and a battery maker. So I thought, you know, the Apple guys would look at it and say, oh, this looks easy. Detroit's a bunch of dinosaurs. There's no way that they're optimized. We can do a better job. And I think as time has gone on, they've learned this business, and they've been very smart about how they've repositioned their ambitions. The important part in the connected car is the data, and Apple is positioning itself to harvest as much of that stuff as possible. And they can do it without building the cars if they build the operating systems for the autonomous self-driving modes. And they might get there first. Google might get there first. It's kind of jump on. It's a really, really exciting time.
One of the things I've always been wondering about is, do you think there's a practical market for Apple to sell an autonomous integrated software system plus sensors? Or do the car companies want to roll their own?
Well, I think in this case, there needs to be standardization. Because the technical part is not necessarily the biggest hurdle in self-driving cars. The regulatory, legal, social part of it is very difficult. And those are very high hurdles to clear.
And I've seen articles in the last year about engineers writing software that makes decisions about whether you're going to kill the driver or run over the little old lady in the crosswalk and make a technical decision about how to handle the dynamics of the car and make decisions like that in an instant.
It's the trolley problem. So if we start from the kind of point that the self-driving car is it's going to have to, it exists for the purpose of greater safety and greater mobility for our citizens. If you start with that premise, which I believe is the kind of point of origin for the technology, cynics might say, okay, it's that data companies want more of our information. But let's not be cynical. Let's just say that it's about mobility. It's about a greater degree of freedom for our aging populations, and it's also more convenient. And you're trading kind of the joys of, say, the muscle car for the convenience of being able to have more free time.
Well, that might help the baby boomers quite a bit,
right?
As they get older and increase their freedom. But one of the questions I've always had about this is, how quickly will these autonomous cars move into the population of cars, and how will that weigh against the younger people who may or may not enjoy what I call the Route 66 romanticism.
Right. And this is a big question. It's all very interconnected. And I think back to this point of safety, that if you are doing this for safety, you're really moving from a voluntary risk where you are the one in control and there's a high degree of self-determination behind the wheel and you feel powerful behind the wheel, to an involuntary risk akin to getting on an airplane. If we're moving from a voluntary risk to an involuntary risk, safety doesn't just have to double. We have to probably reduce fatalities down to the aeronautical level, probably down to zero, as close as we can get. So to do that, everything in the system has to be talking to each other. And if everything's going to be talking to each other, it probably needs a common operating system or one that's highly compatible and as glitch-free as possible.
Or at least communication protocol so that the cars can talk to each other.
Exactly. And so that argues for a common, maybe, Apple operating system. But it also argues for what I think is a really fascinating idea that we're exploring in the next issue. We actually have Malcolm Gladwell as our guest editor for a big autonomy issue we're about to do. And one of the most fascinating things that we've come across is we've been trying to pull all these various threads together and try to look at this in its totality is maybe the semi-autonomous functions that we have now in cars, such as lane keeping or automatic braking, maybe those will not lead directly to full what they call level 5 autonomy. Maybe these are two parallel paths where people can still drive and the things that are fully autonomous without steering wheels, without gas pedals, those are part of a closed loop system that
You mean like trucks and delivery vehicles?
Yeah, domain. Yeah, and maybe they're just operating in cities and maybe they're not replacing cars. Maybe they are making city transportation more efficient, and maybe these are bus replacements. You know, part of me hopes and thinks, and there are a lot of reasons for that, but part of me holds out hope that the word car is gonna remain the thing that you drive, and the self-driving transportation pod is gonna be called something else. But we'll see. And it's a semantic issue, but
well, that's a scenario I haven't seen discussed, and that's a fascinating approach. It all depends on the technology and the sociology of the cars and how the market sort of evolves and how people are feeling about these cars. If you read the websites that talk about this technology, they would have you believe that all cars are going to go to level 5 autonomy. I want to ask you about that in a second. And all cars are going to go that way, and we're all going to be losing our freedom and control. And in just a few years, every car will be autonomous, and there won't be anything like we have today. But I think you're right. I think there is a opportunity here for a segmentation of the market. That mm-hmm. relates to one of the questions I had for you, and that was, so if some people elect to buy fully autonomous cars and other people do not, are there any issues with the mixture of those and on the road? I mean, could bad things happen? Like I've seen stories about road rage and cars, drivers that learn how to bully autonomous cars and make them get out of the way for safety purposes and all sorts of bad sociological, you know, issues with mixture of these kinds of cars on the road. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult. And one of the problems that they've identified is what they call the handoff problem, where say you're not in a full level 5 car, but maybe you're in a level 3 car and it's driving along, driving itself, and all of a sudden something happens and you can't react quickly enough to take control of the vehicle, or it hasn't looked forward. I mean, that to me argues for a non-heterogeneous mix of vehicles on the road, that semi-autonomous cars that are primarily driver-controlled or human-controlled can work with each other. But the level 5 stuff needs this huge matrix of information so that we can achieve peak safety and so that it can avoid all of these ethical and liability gray areas. I mean, think about this scenario. there's a train of cars, self-driving level five cars going up the I-5 in a tight windsheeting array, you know, going 110 miles an hour, very aerodynamically efficient. Let's say that a tire blows in car 17. Who's to blame? Is it the tire company? Is it the software provider? Is it the person who pushed agree on the liability screen?
Well, for the tires, wasn't that decided a few years ago with the Firestone incident on the Ford, was it Escorts?
On Ford Explorers.
Explorers, that Firestone took the heat on that, right?
This is a different thing because a human is not in control. Or what if there's a bird strike in a level five car? And from your space background, I'm sure you dealt with this a lot. What if there's a bird strike and a car is going 120 miles an hour? It takes out the entire front fascia and all its sensors.
Yeah.
Now it's completely haywire. And you're not going to find an autonomous bird that, you know, can communicate with these cars.
Are the insurance companies thinking about charging you a sort of a fee to cover these kinds of emergencies?
We haven't heard yet, but I think that it's definitely an eventuality. And well, what we're talking about here, John, though, is we're talking about trading one set of risks for another set of risks. Mm-hmm. And is that going to be enough? Is risk parity going to be enough? Or do we really have to reduce the risk down to zero for these cars to gain wide social acceptance? You know, this idea has been around since the 50s. Buick, as part of its 1958 Motorama display, had the intelligent highway where cars drove themselves. And this idea has been going for so long. Only now do we have the tech to support it, but I don't think we have the social and legal scaffolding to do so.
Should autonomous cars that are level five have a steering wheel and manual controls? Just in case?
Level five means none of that stuff. Level five is
What if you pull into a parking lot? What if you say, take me to the grocery store? And you get there and it's pouring rain. And the car doesn't know how to troll around and looking for a spot. Or it doesn't know. Or better, you say, pull into the restricted area or the handicap zone so I can run in. And you go find a parking place and wait for me. And the car says, I'm not allowed to park in handicapped. And you have a fight with the car and you say, okay, done. Turn off the system. I'm taking control. I'm parking here. I'm in charge. You know, what about scenarios like that where you need manual controls?
Are we going to be allowed manual controls?
Well, I mean, that's my question.
I don't know. This is a thorny issue. And what we're seeing now is the metaphor of the car being subverted. The car used to be about freedom, going anywhere you wanted at any time and not having to tell anybody.
Yeah, and making decisions. Yeah. I got to tell you a great story. Just thought of a great story. I was in El Paso, Texas, many, many years ago, trolling for a parking spot. And this woman was waiting and waiting and waiting to pull in. She had her flashers on. And as soon as the thing cleared and the person who was leaving the parking spot got out, drove away, this guy came zipping up and he pulled right in and he took her spot.
Yeah.
And she got out of the car and she walked over very gently and she said, hi, I've been waiting. Don't expect there to be any air in your tires when you come back. And we sat there and we watched this and we saw him roll his window back up and we saw him back out of the parking place and leave, and she got her spot. There's all these social things, as you said, about, you know, control and making decisions. And, you know, you're at the hospital and your wife is pregnant and you've got an emergency and the car is fighting you.
Yeah, you know? Or the car needs to go somewhere else. Yeah, like you said. And, you know, I think we really do underestimate how good our brains are and how highly evolved they are.
Mm-hmm.
One of the pieces that we're doing in this Gladwell special edition on autonomy and car and driver is the difference between the human brain and the computer brain. Because the human brain has the limbic system. It has the fight or flight response that guides so many of our decisions non-consciously and gives us feeling, gut feel. And yet, computers are programmed by people with the modern part of their brain, with the frontal part of their brain. And how can you program the fight or flight response into a computer?
Or social cues.
Social
or
cues.
Experience.
Exactly. Yeah. Or a, and will AI do it? AI might have its own priorities.
Yeah, and as we move into autonomous cars, I have a feeling that cars will be ready to, you know, drive between the lines and navigate with GPS long before they're ready to make critical judgments that
That's
make
right.
this process a joy. It's going to be an interesting transition. Do you think that as autonomous cars prove their safety, that it'll be harder and harder to get a driver's license? Do you think that'll translate into governments saying, well, you know, you should be buying an autonomous car because it's safer for you, and we're not going to give you a driver's license because you could buy an autonomous car and you don't need a driver's license?
It's entirely possible. And that's not a decision that we want government. Personally, I'm saying I don't want the government making that decision for me.
How well, that's a political, social issue that we'll have to figure out how to deal with, because if it's left to itself, I think that the governments will always opt for the safer, more conservative approach.
Exactly.
So there's got to be some sort of public forum and discussion with our government about how that's going to happen. That's going to be tricky, too. Yeah.
Exactly. Lots of issues. It's not just about the technology, which itself is not completely fail-safe, as we know. I mean, we're right at the beginning of this, and it's going to take a long time for it to fully play out. And all the myths that are kind of floating around, that autonomous cars are out there now, and that they're going to obviate human-driven cars, I think it's much too early to tell any of that.
How long do you think this transition will take? What I mean is going to the point where autonomous cars are, you know, desirable and fully instantiated on the road, and we have a proper mix and these issues have been resolved. Some websites would have you believe it's going to happen next year, but I have a suspicion it's going to take a lot longer.
A lot longer, but then all at once. Like all technologies achieve critical mass, it bumbles along, and then all of a sudden, boom, network effect.
Yeah. Do you think there are car companies that are not well equipped to compete in this arena, and that Apple or other companies might help them carry the load? Because if car companies don't, you know, compete properly in this arena, they could be out of business.
Well, you see that already a little bit, that car companies are saying, you know what, the center screen, we just can't keep up with all of the...
like the Tesla.
Yeah, like... The product cycles of the car are 7 years typically, 5 to 7 years, 4 to 7 years. But the product cycles of a phone are much quicker. And you see a lot of car companies saying, you know what, we're not going to try to keep up with Apple when it comes to the center stack and keeping it fresh. Maybe Tesla can, but a lot of them are opting for CarPlay and phone mirroring systems on the center stack. And that gets updated with your phone. So we're already starting to see it. I don't know if it's an existential threat, though. It's an existential threat to the data and what they can put in front of their customer. But building cars is very, very difficult. I will tell you what is also kind of scary is, let's say we do achieve the singularity around level 5 autonomy, and all of these hard-won dynamic attributes, the things that make a Porsche different than a Corvette, different than a Nissan, they all sort of go away when you're not driving. The driving character of the car and that sense of connection of the rider and the horse, you know, something that Mazda talks about with the Miata all the time, that goes away. And I think there's a lot at risk there, to tell you the truth, John. I think... We, you know, just as we underestimate the potential and power of our brain, I think we underestimate what driving, the mere act of piloting in a car does to our brains. This is a theory of mine, and
I like it.
I've been laughed on a lot of rooms because of it, but I'm going to say it.
I like it.
I think that American ingenuity is tied to the automobile. We do some of our best thinking behind the wheel because our brain's kind of non-conscious functions are occupied, and it frees up our conscious minds to really fly. And
it's like getting that great idea in the shower. There's right. Time and place where your brain does the right thing.
Your hands are moving. They're occupied. They're happy. Your brain is kind of free to survey the surroundings and also to think. Your imagination can soar. And I've had some of my best ideas driving. I've done some of my best problem solving on the highway. And I wonder if, you know, the car is driving for you, are we still going to be able to exercise?
That's a great, that's I love that. That is great thinking on your part. I will be wondering about that for months.
Well, and, you think crazy. Thank you.
On that note, I think we're going to have to wrap up. We've gone a little bit over time, and I let that happen because the discussion has been so great.
I want to
thank you so much for being on the show and sharing with us your views on autonomous cars and the car industry. This has been fabulous. I think the listeners are going to really enjoy this show.
Great. Thank you, John. Thanks for the great questions, and thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure. So tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
You can get to me at editors@carandriver.com. And please pick up the November issue of Car and Driver, because I think it's going to be fascinating. And some of the stuff we touched on today will be in there. And the stories are just great.
Excellent. I'll be looking forward to it. I am a subscriber, so I will have it.
Thanks for letting me plug that.
All right. Excellent. Listeners, we thank you for joining us on the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you next week.